Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you're listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latar Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latarrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latarrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And like I said, I am Radio Johnny, and going to skip the calendar for this week, but you can find it at that latarrecoverycenter.org website. I'm going to dive right into our guest today, whose name is Kurt. Kurt, welcome.
Thanks, Johnny.
And Kurt, why don't you give people a little idea of your background? Were you born a poor child in a rundown tenement in Mississippi, or was it different than
Not quite. Born in Missoula, Montana. My dad was getting his master's in organic chemistry. He and my mom had just gotten married 9.5 months before I was born.
I see.
She was 19 and he was 20. So I was born in Missoula, lived there for a while, moved to Seattle where he got his PhD, spent through third grade in Seattle.
Oh, nice.
No, that's not right. Spent through kindergarten in Seattle and then moved to Edmonton, Alberta, where he postdocked.
Oh.
First, second, and third grade. And then moved to Pullman in fourth grade and finished out there. So I went to Pullman, Franklin Elementary, Lincoln Middle School, and Pullman High School until I was into my sophomore year, and then started rodeo and riding bulls.
Oh, boy.
And my mom hated it, didn't want me riding bulls, and so they ended up buying me a horse so I could start roping. They figured the rodeo thing was going to stick, and so they bought me a horse, and then we didn't have any place to keep it, so they bought a place over by Colfax.
Uh-huh.
And so I finished junior and senior year in Colfax.
So you could be a rodeo guy.
Well, so I could, yeah. I mean, I look back on that. I spent a number of years resenting my parents. But when I really think of the things that they did for me,
right,
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I went to WSU, started drinking somewhere along the line there. About 13, I think, was when I first started drinking. And it was long overdue. I needed a drink by the time I was 13. It lived in my head a lot. Had some relatively traumatic couple of years with bullies when I was in fifth and sixth grade, and that kind of, I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but that kind of set the tone and pulled out of that and got to where by the time I got to junior and senior year, I was having a great time, and I was drinking as often as I could. I knew I didn't drink like everybody else.
Right.
It did something special for me that it didn't do for my friends. And
right.
And I wanted as much of it as I could get, as often as I could get. And, you know, through high school, that was relatively, it didn't happen all the time.
Because
I just couldn't get it, right?
Couldn't
buy it, didn't have friends that could buy it. And so I drank, you know, as often as I could. And I know I'm an alcoholic for a couple of reasons. I know I'm an alcoholic because when I drink, I'm not sure what's going to happen. If I take the first drink, I don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes I can stick with my plan, and sometimes I don't stick with my plan, and I just keep drinking until I create bad situations. Generally, they don't generally end well. Let's put it that way. And the
just
other one
the
is
wheels
is that
come off.
Yeah, till I run out of money, till there's no more alcohol, or till something happens, till I pass out. Right, go to
right.
sleep. I used to call it going to sleep, but
right.
And the other way I know I'm an alcoholic is that when I can't stay stopped, I could stop drinking. I'd get disgusted with myself, and I would say, "This has got to stop. I know it's a problem. I'm not going to ever drink again." And And that would last varying periods of time, but eventually I would drink again.
Sure.
I could not stay stopped. And that lasted, you know, my story is largely uneventful. I got a DUI when I was 21 on my 21st birthday.
Nice.
And yeah, nice.
Happy
and,
birthday.
Happy birthday, exactly. You know, what I really started doing was using relationships to control my drinking, because I somehow could pick the people that I wanted to be in a relationship with, that I'd set my sights on and go get, would take one look at my drinking and they would say, I don't want any part of this, right? And I would stop, right? And I'd stop for the length of the relationship, generally, a few times, you know, mostly.
Right.
But I got miserable every single time. My personality would, everything turned black and white in the world. Eventually generate a resentment that would cause me to leave or would cause me to be kicked out, right? My behavior would deteriorate.
Right.
And then I'd drink again, like 15 minutes later. You know, right. There was never any, oh, we should work on this. Let's work it out. No, it's like, nope, I'm heading to the liquor store. Right. And that happened 3 or 4 times. And I got sober when I was 36. So I drank for 23 years. And by the time I got done, I knew alcohol was the problem. And I could not stay stopped. And I was surrounding myself with lower and lower companions.
Sure.
To justify to myself that my own drinking, and at the same time, my life was getting smaller and smaller. I couldn't be in a relationship. You know, relationships were shorter, fewer and farther between.
Right.
Couldn't stay in a relationship. I had distanced myself from my family. I didn't have my close friends, my childhood friends. I didn't really have any relationships, but I still had a job. I still had a car, a place to live, all these things that, you know, mm-hmm. I could still convince myself sort of on the outside that things were okay.
Right.
Except I was dying on the inside.
Right. Right. And I know what you mean when you talk about that, the world's getting smaller. You know, it's when we withdraw, you know, it's when we isolate, because we actually prefer that.
Completely.
Sad as that is, because we don't need anybody around messing with our drinking.
Yeah.
So, like, we intentionally do that. I think that's one of the defense mechanisms that alcohol has. It wants to protect us from those that would keep us away from our one true love.
Question our drinking. Yep. It was, I was having a relationship with alcohol and everything else was ancillary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I learned to lie to myself super effectively during that time. I thought I wasn't, I guess the way I heard it best is my bottom has, you know, the bottom that I hit that brought me into AA has gotten lower and lower the longer that I've stayed sober, because I'm starting to realize how much I was farther down the trail than I thought I was. Right. Mm-hmm. I said I was, you know, I would convince myself I wasn't a daily drinker, except at the end I was drinking every day.
Right, sure.
You know. It just didn't somehow equate.
Right.
It's different when it's me. Right.
And, right, exactly. If you had my life, you'd drink too. Or especially what you said about surrounding your people yourself with people that not only drank like you did, but drank harder than you did.
Oh yeah, they were worse. They were doing other things. Right.
Right? Another way we rationalize our behavior.
Oh yeah.
Right. I'm not as bad as them.
Well, I knew I was an alcoholic because if it was my money, I bought alcohol.
Right.
If it was your money, I don't care what you had, I'd do anything that came along.
Right.
But
sure.
If it was my money, if I had to spend my money, I was buying alcohol because it was consistent. It never quit working for me. What I got out of drinking was that, you know, 30-minute to 2-hour euphoria,
mm-hmm.
where everything was right with the world.
Right.
All the voices in my head were saying the same thing.
Right. Right.
We were all on the same page.
Yep.
And then I'd chase it. I'd be afraid I was going to lose that feeling. I'd keep drinking. I'd overshoot the mark, and I'd get sloppy. And now I'm sloppy. Sorry. Oh, now I'm sloppy. And, you know, I knew I had a problem. The night I quit drinking was I was on the beach in Puerto Vallarta, with a bunch of lower companions. And I thought I was having a ball.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Except that, And I was mostly a pretty agreeable guy when I drank. I just mm-hmm. wanted to get drunk, and I'm not a fighter. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't get in people's faces except when I did, very often. That night, however, I proved to be the lowest of the lower companions. And I've heard the definition of a bottom is I can't lower my standards fast enough to keep up with what's happening in the real world, in my life. And right. that night, it struck me full on that, oh, why are you doing this? Why are you being such a jerk, right? And they were not afraid to tell me they didn't want anything to do with me. And here I was, mm-hmm. you know, in Puerto Vallarta at 2 a.m, drunk on my butt and not able to, didn't even know where I was. And a guy took pity on me at the bar that I was drinking at and didn't want to see me get killed. And so he just said, I'll walk you back to your hotel. And in that walk, he didn't talk about AA. I found out later he's sober 15 years, but I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And he didn't talk about AA. He didn't say you need to go to a meeting. You're an alcoholic. He didn't say any mm-hmm. of those things. What he did talk about was his higher power. You mm-hmm. know, the relationship that he had spiritually. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'd known it before, but I realized that, you know, I was spiritually bankrupt. I needed something else in my life. Alcohol's a terrible god.
Right.
It was my god, and it's a terrible god. It's
the rapacious creditor.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't care in right. the slightest about my happiness. In fact, it doesn't care whether I live or die.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It just wants me to drink. And I realized that night, and the door just opened a crack that, okay, maybe I don't know what's going on. Maybe I need some help. And it took me a little bit to get to an AA meeting and I finally did. And at that first AA meeting, the only thing I remember from the first AA meeting was they asked me to read the promises, which are the ninth step promises in AA, which are a list of things that can happen if mm-hmm. you get to the ninth, halfway through the ninth step is what
right.
it says. Right.
Right. We're halfway through.
Yeah, yeah. And one of them is you will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle you. And that hooked me. Said, okay, that's what I want.
Mm-hmm.
I felt baffled my entire life. Everybody else had the playbook and I didn't. I was just, you know, I was acting. And sure. I started that at about 5 years old. I can remember when I was four and, you know, some really early memories where I just had uncomplicated joy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it stopped. And I started acting.
Mm-hmm.
And what do I need to be in this situation to get the validation that I need? And what I've realized recently is that it's all been about, a lot of it's been about, you know, not knowing my own worth and value.
Mm-hmm.
And really not knowing it at all, right? Feeling right. like I didn't have worth and value, mm-hmm. really. But that's a mistake. Everybody has worth and value. But
right.
I could see it in others. Mm-hmm. I can look at you and know your worth and value without question, mm-hmm. whether no matter how you behave. That's just unskillful behavior,
mm-hmm.
right? But your worth and value isn't affected.
Right.
But I couldn't see that for myself.
Right.
And that's what I was trying to extract out right. of the universe. And when I drank, I didn't have that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I did recognize, right, my worth and value, except it was based on alcohol, which was fake.
Right, right. Right?
Right. It didn't last.
Right.
Right? If I could have stayed drunk
right.
all the time.
In that window. That 15 minutes to yeah. 1 hour, yeah. yeah.
That three martini window,
yeah.
right, where it's just like everything's perfect, mm-hmm. then I would have done that. But I couldn't ever. And it never was, it was getting harder and harder to access mm-hmm. that, right? It didn't last as long. It wasn't consistent, right? And so I got sober and I started going to meetings. And very short, I broke all the rules in my first year of sobriety.
Right. I got in a relationship
and I moved because of that relationship from Seattle to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. At 4 months of sobriety, and I'd hardly been to any meetings before I did that. I was just really beginning, mm-hmm. and fell into the sobriety community in Los Angeles, which was just absolutely fantastic. It was perfect for me.
Mm-hmm.
My partner was sober.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of our life, right?
Right.
And it worked super well. And I got a really good basis, even though I'm a mediocre student of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not an aggressive pursuer of the steps. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
I took my time to do it. Because the fellowship worked really good, right? I got a lot of the validation that I wanted, and until that, what started to not be enough. And then I needed to get a sponsor. I just didn't know what to do. And well, everybody else gets a sponsor, so I'll get a sponsor and I'll work the steps. And the first guy I asked ended up, I got to did the fifth step with him. Fourth step is made a first searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves.
Right.
I did the best I could on that, which was more of an autobiography, not particularly searching and thorough or fearless.
And
read it to my sponsor. And then I knew that eighth and ninth step, which is made a list of everybody we had harmed and then became willing to make amends to them. I saw that coming and I said, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I don't have any intention of, I like this AA stuff. I have no intention of doing that.
Right.
Because that just horrified me.
Right.
And so that raised me to another level of the scaffold. I got some benefit out of doing that. Mm-hmm. And I coasted for a while and then got miserable again and asked another guy to sponsor me. And he was the first sponsor that I worked thoroughly through the steps with and saw some of the things that I didn't want to see about myself.
They say once we go through that fifth step, we look at some of our grosser handicaps.
Right. Yeah.
And I found that to be really true for myself. I went through the steps. I picked a guy out I thought was an easy mark. He was a combo sober alcohol heroin. He was a world-class surfer, lived in Hawaii, And big mistake. He had a really strong program.
That's awesome.
and he enforced that on me. Well, it was my fault. I mean, he said, are you willing to go to any length? And foolishly, I said yes.
Well, of course, because that's the right answer. That's the expected answer, right? What am I going to say?
And when he said, okay, hit your knees, we're going to say this third step prayer. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute.
Wait a second.
Back up a little bit. Yeah, that's, do we have to, yeah. But, yeah, no.
Speaking of spirituality, I mean, the 12 steps says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually happened to me. I came in without any concept of God. I didn't. Mm-hmm. My dad was a scientist. We went to church on Easter and Christmas because I think my folks thought I needed.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that they did what what people thought they should do. Right.
Right.
But
sure,
we didn't
sure.
have God in our lives when I was growing up. And then I got a bachelor's in wildlife biology and had, embraced science and, mm-hmm. Was vocal,
right,
often wrong, but never in doubt about my beliefs. And
not much of a creationist, yeah.
No, it was the opposite. And, I thought religion was the opiate of the masses. And
Karl Marx.
And that is, for me, had proven to be a pretty empty way to live. I needed spirituality, not religion necessarily, but spirituality.
Right. Yeah, they don't always equal each other.
Well, and thank God AA is a big tent because if I would have come in there and they would have said, you have to believe this way about this thing,
right,
I would have never stayed.
Right.
And they didn't. They said, you can believe whatever you want to believe here, right? You just need something that's not you.
Right.
And I already knew how to do that because I'd done it real successfully with alcohol for a long time. So it wasn't beyond my capacity to do that.
It's like our friend Tom says, they said I had to believe, but they didn't tell me what.
Mm-hmm. Which is awesome, right?
Yeah.
That's what allowed me to stay. Because
right.
if it's one of my soapboxes in AA, which is a Christian dog whistle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, we know it says, the God of our understanding, but mm-hmm. really what they meant was this. And that's, in my opinion, is not correct. No, not true. No, because and they harmful.
Were. Yeah, they yeah. were very aware. That why do you think the you know the second chapter in the book is called "To the Agnostics"?
Right.
Yeah, you know.
No, it's you know, and it's and it and you know, and they did kind. I mean, and it was based on some stuff that came from.
Certainly.
It was based on the Oxford Group. It was based on some things
Washingtonians
that,
yeah.
that were Christians, right? And that's fine. It's nothing. There's nothing wrong with
right.
with that, right? There's just it's just not the only game in town.
Right, right. Exactly.
I think it, you know, people think it's, I've had this conversation probably three or four times in the last month with people that, isn't that a, you know, Christian mm-hmm. program? It's like, I wish we could dispel that notion.
Right.
Because it's just really not.
Right.
You know, and if anybody tells you is, it's, that's like I heard on a speaker's tape one time. It's like, well, that's BB.
Right? Yeah.
I said, well, what's BB? Well, I don't know what BB is, but it's not AA. Right. So,
right.
You know, if anybody's telling you that you have to believe this way or do this kind of stuff, then
right.
then that's not the program.
Right. Right. Well, they called them suggestions. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested
as a program
of recovery.
Yeah. Right. You know, and that's proven true because I've done, you know, I've done both. I've been hardcore locked on at times and I've done half-ass
mm-hmm.
approach and you know I got benefit out of both. I got a lot more benefit out of actually trying.
Right Right. Yeah, you know, going along with it, you know, and we were talking about before we got into the show, we were talking about, you know, a little bit of our histories, and we hit that plateau where we think we got it figured out. And then something sparks us in an event or somebody saying something that pushes us to realize, you know, that we don't got it.
Right.
That there's still more growth to be had and more work to be done. And that doesn't stray far away from, you know, exactly what you're describing.
Right.
Which is my belief in my higher power, which I call the God of my non-understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not going to be so obnoxious to say I know what God is,
right?
You know, in a way, I'm envious of the Christians because they have this perfect model, well documented, for you know what a manner of living that
this is how you
has
should
to
believe.
Be honest, yep. and a belief system which is, you know, well defined and spelled out. I had to. You know, I have to figure out my own higher power and figure out how to communicate with that higher power.
And it changes all the time for
right,
me. I mean,
right.
Mine has changed. You know, when I got in, there was enough, you know, just that door, just the door opening a crack, just maybe, mm-hmm. maybe there's something else in the universe that I don't understand.
Right.
Right. Was enough to keep me sober for quite a while. And then it got deeper. I mean, I went through confirmation and with the Episcopalians when I was, you know, 2 or 3 years sober and mm-hmm. thought that, you know, I loved the high church. I loved the swinging incense. It felt mm-hmm. super sense of calm. You know, the teachings themselves, I actually did, you know, like I couldn't suspend my disbelief long enough to,
right.
to really buy in 100%, yeah. but it brought me a lot of comfort and it gave me something to pray to.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when I got afraid, right, that's when I really see the benefit. And when I know it's working for me is when
right.
I get really afraid.
Mm-hmm.
There's something to turn that over to. I don't have to just sit with it myself. And it's
right.
happened a couple times. One of them when my kids were born, both times. It's like, oh, the overwhelming sense of responsibility scared the hell out of me. It's
mm-hmm.
like, oh, my God, I'm responsible for this
right.
life, right?
Right?
And I don't know what I'm doing.
I have to keep this alive.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. The other time was I got a cancer diagnosis when I was 13 years ago. So, yeah, about 13 years sober. You know, my kids were little, 6 and 8 or something like that. And I was afraid I wasn't going to get to see them grow up. I wasn't
yeah.
get to be there for them. And it scared the hell out of me. And my first response was just, okay, God, take this. If I spend 1 second thinking about this, I'm lost.
Right.
Right. I'm not going to be able to deal with it myself.
Right.
And it worked. It was there, right? I was able to maintain a level of equanimity through that
mm-hmm.
You know, that took me by surprise. Probably the most miraculous thing that's ever happened to me in AA. This goes back to the bullies. was I was 15 years sober. I'd gotten miserable again. I go on about a 5-year cycle with the steps, or I was used to be in that, right? Where I'd do the steps and then I'd be fine for 5 years and then I'd get miserable and I'd work the steps again. And so at about 15, I worked the steps again and we got to the eighth step, and these guys that I'd made the mistake of putting them on my fourth step, and which I hadn't done before. And so I'd gotten a little bit more honest, and my sponsor said, well, they need to be on, you know, I'd made my eighth step list, and those guys weren't on it. And he said, they need to be on your eighth step list. And I told him to go to hell. I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm not making that amends. I hate those guys. I always will. They ruined my life. Mm-hmm. Right? That's how I felt, honestly, how I felt at that point. Because, you know, the narrative I was telling myself at 50, right? Mm-hmm. 50 years old was all still about what happened to me when I was 10. Right? Mm-hmm. And I was basing daily decisions on stuff that happened to me 40 years ago. Right. And in terms of my self-worth, my value, you know, my ability, you know, just how I approached other people, how I was in relationships and in situations, right? It affected all kinds of things for me. It was super deep. And so he was a great sponsor. He was super patient. He just said, you know what, let's just sit here. Think about this, see what happens. Because, you know, I explained that the eighth step is not about going and asking for their forgiveness so much as it is about that. But it's also about forgiving them. You can't do it. You can't just ask for their forgiveness without also how can you ask somebody to forgive you if you're not willing to forgive them?
Right.
Right. And that forgiveness piece, boy, was it a struggle for me.
Sure.
For those guys. There was nobody, really nobody else in my life that I had trouble with that with. I don't hold grudges. I don't keep resentments, except that one. That one was a biggie. And I sat on it for 8 months, and finally I was at my daughter's softball game one day, and I just took out my phone and I wrote them down on the list, and it was just gone. It still makes me emotional when I think about it, because it was like 40 years of resentment.
Right.
And daily thinking about, you know, and basing my decision, my behavior on them was just gone. It was just like gone. Right. And I still can't explain it. And it's never come back. I don't hold any, and I don't have to think about that stuff anymore.
Right.
And it was, you know, I still have trouble believing that kind of stuff can happen. Right. I hear other people tell me those stories.
Right.
Right, and I go, well, you know, there's always this voice in my head going, well, you know, there's probably an explanation for that. You know, they're just not looking at it quite right. But
it's just,
you know,
a miracle of science.
When it happens to me, then
it's not a spiritual
miracle, right? And so that was that. And then about 5 years ago, ended up realizing that I was in a relationship that couldn't continue, and it had been 20 years. And we were getting sicker together fast. And I learned the value of a couple other programs. My partner, I had 10 years of sobriety. They had 25 years of sobriety, and they drank in the middle of the... And I learned the value of Al-Anon.
Right.
Right. Because we had little kids. I didn't know I had absolutely no idea what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the time when I was super scared. And... you know, I went to Al-Anon, and Al-Anon, you know, hated it for 6 months, and then fell in love with the program. It's such a wonderful program. If you have people that in your life that are drinking,
right,
Al-Anon is such a good answer for that.
Yeah. I made the mistake of marrying a normie.
Oh yeah,
those people, you know, well, those half a glass of wine.
Whatever.
Leave the rest.
Never understood that.
No.
Alcohol abuse.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Because my philosophy is because you can drink, you should drink as much as you possibly can.
Right, right. Why would you not take advantage of this gift?
You're so, if I could drink, my favorite is if I could drink like a normal person, I'd do it every day.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And then the story about, you hear they created a pill that cures alcoholism. Oh, I wonder
what
Tool
will do. I just heard that the other night for the first time.
Yeah.
Well, boy, 3 would probably be good.
Wow, yeah.
Cure some other stuff. Yeah, so that divorce, that's kind of when I went through the, you know, I didn't, I didn't know if AA was going to be able to help me or not with that. And I was in South Dakota. I didn't have a strong community there. I hadn't connected with AA like I like I had been connected up to that point. And you know, looking back, I want to blame AA there for that. It was me.
Right. Sure.
I was marching down the road that I hear over and over again.
Right.
That I was marching down the road to a drink. Right. I was distancing myself from AA. Didn't like the meetings. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was a long way from any support group that I had. Mm-hmm. And which was all back in Seattle. That's where I spent the majority of my sobriety, was Seattle. And I wasn't calling people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure.
And a couple things intervened. COVID intervened. COVID happened and meetings went online. And I started going to my home group in Seattle every morning. It was every morning at 7, there was a meeting. And I started, got reconnected back to the people that I'd spent 15 years with. And that got me. And then in that meeting, I found a sponsor. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time in my sobriety that I'd connected with a sponsor. Really connected at a deep level. I've always envied people that had that relationship with their sponsor.
Right.
I'd never had that relationship with sponsors. They were friends, right? I'd do what they say, but there was never a soul connection, for lack of a better term.
Sure,
and,
sure.
Yeah. And with this guy, there is, right? He's a he's a teacher, me, and so we started doing the steps, and he sponsors way different. Sponsors out of the 12 and 12. And so we started reading through the 12 and 12. And, I had 24, 23 years of sobriety at that time. He had 30 years of sobriety. You know, it wasn't our first rodeo.
Right, sure.
And I'm not sure that doing that with somebody brand new would be beneficial. But, you know, more and more, as you stay sober longer and longer, alcohol becomes, is not the problem.
Right.
Right. Living is the problem.
Right. Right.
How do I take this mind out into the world? Right. And and it's still an alcoholic mind. I mean, I still.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I still regularly will think, I told this story the other night, but I'd be sitting in a meeting, and I've probably gone. I mean, this is going to sound insane to anybody listening to this, but I go to a lot of meetings. I've probably gone to 5 meetings a week for 26 years.
Right.
So that adds up to a bunch of meetings.
Yeah, it does.
Right? That's like,
thousands.
Thousands of meetings.
Yeah.
Thousands of AA meetings. Right? And I will still regularly be sitting in an AA meeting, and my head will, not too regularly, once or twice a year, and I'll hear something, right? I'll hear somebody say something, and my head will go, maybe you just overreacted 26 years ago. Right? Maybe you're not an alcoholic.
Right.
Maybe you could drink.
Right.
Right? It's like the depth of the insanity around alcohol, the depth of the insane thinking that I have. I can't tell this to my sponsees, but you cannot trust a single thought. I cannot trust a single thought I have about drugs and alcohol.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Because the disease is playing chess. It's out there working to get me loaded. And I have to, I have to recognize that. And it's not a big deal. It's not like I spend all day, life is
fretting about it. Yeah,
my
sure.
Life is wonderful, right? I mean, sobriety has paid off far beyond. I mean, it's just like I can't even describe,
right,
how great it has been being sober. What the gifts that it has brought me in my life.
I mean, I've been in my drinking days. I was down to, bankrupt, broke, period, and unemployable, and the marriage hanging by a thread, still out of the house and the car, but, the bank was looking at both of those, kind of leering at them, wanting them back.
We like those things.
Yeah. And, but where I am now, I mean, I have a comfortable retirement.
Yep.
I'm able to spend a few hours a week doing this as volunteer work and not worry about getting paid for it. I'm able to go on nice vacations if I want. In my career, I was fairly well respected. Well, sorry, Mike, maybe not by you, but my former boss, who listens to this show. I love
mostly
you,
respected.
You're not on my resentment list anymore. Anyway, I did a lot of good things, and it's all because of not drinking, but more so getting into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and learning how to live life on life's terms.
Right.
Because it doesn't work on Johnny's terms.
Well, the main thing I've learned in that time is that it's not about me.
Right.
Right. It's about service. It's about what can I give back. It's about being, and I've recognized it in the last 3 years just is that this is, AA, it ties into it's a valid spiritual path all in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need anything else, right? But it parallels all the major religions, right? It parallels Buddhism. It parallels, I know Buddhism the best. There's a concept in Buddhism called Bodhisattva, which is I will achieve enlightenment so that I can benefit all sentient beings.
Right.
Right. I'm vowing to serve all sentient beings for immeasurable time to get them to enlightenment, right? Well, there's not much difference between I will achieve sobriety so that I can, help another alcoholic achieve sobriety.
That's
our primary purpose. It tells us that in our literature over, in a couple of different places.
Sure.
I have a primary purpose, right? It's to stay sober so that I can help another alcoholic be sober, period. And that path all by itself is 100%. It's all I need, right? It's all anybody needs to get out of themselves, right? To let go of our ego. What am I going to get? What's coming from me? Happiness comes from the outside.
Right.
Right? And, I just need to acquire more.
Right,
to
exactly.
180-degree different, what can I give?
Right.
And
The concept of giving it away to keep it.
And that's where true happiness comes from, right? Although my brain does not see that equation left to its own devices.
Right.
It thinks that I need to get more.
And here's the thing, like I mentioned before, my wife is a normal temperate drinker.
Right.
She's also not insane like I am.
Right.
And the biggest kick she gets out of life is helping other people. Who knew?
Right. Same thing.
Right. But she didn't need the program to do that.
She wasn't driven to the program by,
Yeah.
She didn't set the building on fire.
Right, exactly.
Run out of it and then expect a merit badge for it.
Right, exactly. For putting it out. Yeah.
That's one of my, whenever our, we celebrate it. Birthdays in it, birthdays. We call them birthdays in AA, right? Our sobriety date.
Right.
And, I always have that thought around my birthday, which is, well, okay, so you're congratulating me for running out of a burning building that I set on fire.
Right.
Where is the merit in that?
Right, exactly. What exactly why do I just, am I just why am feeling I getting, like I need a pat on the back?
I don't need a pat on the back for this. I need to go out and help other people.
Right.
And, it's becoming more and more that for me. I did an exercise recently that I had never done in my entire life, which was sit down with a list of values, right? Potential. Mm-hmm. Here's 200 potential values, right? Mm-hmm. Things that I could dedicate my life to.
Sure.
Pick out three of, go through it, find the three that resonate with you the most, and then work on matching my behavior with those values. I'd never done that. I wish we would have done that in kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade. Every single year our kids should be doing that.
Right.
Just because I didn't have a clue. My values were entirely situational.
Mm-hmm.
What do I need my values to be to get what I want?
Right.
Right. Rather than what are my values so that I can know what my behavior needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's made a tremendous difference in my happiness.
Mm-hmm.
The counterintuitive thing here is that my happiness, my serenity and my joy, my true happiness grows independent of what's happening on the outside, right? My life is messy. There's always stuff going to happen, right? We don't have any control over it. We don't know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
Things are going to just keep happening. And if my happiness is based on a set of conditions outside of me for me to be happy, then I'm then I'm screwed.
Right, right, because right? they will never
they'll
come to
never
fruition.
Line up.
Or, if, well, yeah, line up. They'll never be, when things do come through, for me, they're always like lacking.
Well, then what do I, yeah, because they last, you know, the joy lasts, the pleasure lasts for an hour.
Right.
And then it's like, and now what? What's
right,
next?
Exactly.
Now what's going to happen? Right? I want more. Right? With us, right? With me, it's like, no, that was good. I want more of that. I want to feel even better than that.
And
right?
It manifests itself in all sorts of weird ways. For me, I was probably 20 years sober, and I decided I was going to build my own computer, you know, from components and whatnot. And my career was in computer manufacturing, so not a stretch. So I spent a lot of time researching, you know, this motherboard and, you know, which processor works the best with it and, you know, graphics cards and memory and, you know, the speed and latency and all, you know, doing all these calculations and ordered all the parts and put them all together and it worked great. And then I was like, okay, now what?
Right.
You know, I'll surf the web on dial-up.
Well, yeah, and 5 minutes later, there's something new.
Right.
Right. Right. And it's like, well, all of a sudden then, the thing that I thought was going to bring me happiness causes me suffering. Well, my computer's not good enough.
Right? Right.
There's impermanence in the world. Right.
Right.
Things
exactly.
change. We never know what's going to happen.
That's
and,
right.
You know, it's you know, I heard people say when I, there was people in the meetings that would say when I first came in, that said, I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Right.
And I would like,
are you nuts?
Out of your mind?
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, more and more as the years go by, that phrase is true for
right.
me. I'm super grateful that I had the causes and conditions
right.
that allowed me or forced me, allowed me whatever to get into this program. And I'm very, right. very grateful that I had that it worked for me.
Right.
Right. That I was able to pick it up, you know, suspend my disbelief long enough to actually try it.
Right.
And patient enough to let the results come. Right. And
sure.
I don't know where those came from, but I'm super grateful for them because now I get to be of service.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I get to help other people to the best of my ability. And I never know whether what you're saying or doing is helping
right.
anybody.
Right.
Right. You just do the best you can.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
And try. Right. And, you know, try to keep the ego from coming in there and, you know, where's mine?
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, so many of us, you know, me in particular, when I was drinking, I thought I was a very generous, caring, giving guy.
Oh, I believed that hook, line, and sinker.
As long as I got the
as
strokes.
Long as you didn't get between me and what I wanted.
Right, right. Or as long as I got the strokes after I helped
Absolutely,
you out.
Absolutely, the validation, right?
Yeah,
if you provided the validation, then I was a nice guy.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
If you didn't, or I didn't think, or I didn't want validation, I mean, I've just realized pretty recently that vast swaths of the human race just didn't exist for me because I didn't want their validation.
Right.
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 And it's, God, what an ugly character defect that is, right? It's like
the only place to live.
These people are like, you know, everybody has something that they do better than me.
Right. Sure.
Right. Every single person has
lots.
Qualities right there. And they've got this love, you know, they're this base nature that is loving and kind.
Right.
Right. And compassionate. I think that's how we are as
right.
people. It just gets covered up by all this other stuff.
Mm.
And, you know, we behave unskillfully, right? Mm. It helps me so much to be able to look at people and go, you know, their actions, they're super unskillful.
Right.
Sounds judgmental, but really it's not. You know, I don't think it's overly judgmental because there are some unskillful behaviors out there.
Well, yeah, we have to make judgments.
It's
what keeps us alive
right.
from, you know, walking off a cliff.
Exactly.
I think I could survive this fall.
Yeah, no,
wait a minute.
Bad judgment. Natural selection has honed
right.
judgment
right.
over the years, right?
That's
and,
right.
and so we just get to...
But being able to recognize, you know, where somebody is, where they're at. Something interesting along that line when, you know, in sobriety, I mean, I've always been able to talk to people, whatever. My sister used to said, oh, there's to him, there's no strangers, just people he hasn't met yet.
That's how.
But in sobriety, I learned to be able to, you know, meet people where they are and actually, even if they're, what they're talking about is, you know, not quote my bag, I'm interested, you know, I can stay engaged and, you know, listen to them through before, you know, I tell them they're, you know, a little slow. No.
Explain it like I'm five.
Right, right. Tell me, what is this algebra you speak of? X, Y, I don't understand.
You know, but it helps me a lot to you know, it's a practice that I do, walking around, looking at people, and, mm-hmm. and you know, it's called Just Like Me. And just like me, mm-hmm. they're trying to be happy. Mm-hmm. The hardest. They're doing their best to be happy and to avoid suffering. Mm-hmm. Just like me. That's what I'm trying to do. Right?
Well, that's very Buddhist.
It is Buddhist. Yeah. It's a foundational Buddhist practice,
right.
actually.
But exactly.
It's and then, you know, there's a lot of good things in Buddhism. Just like there's a lot of good things in Christianity, I'm sure there's a lot of good things in Muslim religion. I'm sure there's a lot of good things. You know, they all have good things. Unfortunately, people get involved.
Right. it does kind of screw up,
You know, because, I mean, if everybody was living like Jesus, you know, he was a radical.
Right,
he was
exactly.
saying things that there's nobody in, you know.
His own people killed him.
if you look at who.
The emperor said, no, I'm not dealing with this.
We're not dealing with this. If you look at, you know, all of the people that do what the St. Francis prayer says, right?
Right.
Bring love where there's hatred, right?
Yeah.
Bring understanding where there's, right. where there's
bring
whatever.
Peace,
you know,
where
I can't
there's
remember.
Dispute.
Yeah, peace where there's war, right? I
right.
mean, they get killed.
Right.
Right? That's not a simple, that's not a peaceful prayer.
No.
It's asking you to do.
Well, to step into the line of fire.
Radical things.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
It's like. You know, when people, I hear it all the time. It's like, oh, I just love that prayer. It's just so peaceful. It's like, I'm not sure we're reading the same prayer.
Certainly not interpreting it the same.
So it's.
No, it's not.
I'm not sure that. Yeah, it's like, I'm not, you know, do I have that level of commitment?
Right.
Right. And it's just, life is just getting more and more full of wonder mm-hmm. as I stay sober longer. Which I didn't expect.
Right.
I thought I'd get to a place and I would get everything I wanted, right? I'd get my cookie,
mm-hmm.
right? Talk about this with new guys working the steps. It's like, so what are you expecting out of this,
right?
What are you expecting out of your journey through the steps? And, you know, most of the time they don't have any answer. But then it's like, if you probably have an expectation that things are going to improve in ways that you
approve of.
Yeah, that you approve of.
Right.
And, you know, that may not be what happens.
Right. Probably is not going to be what happens.
I mean, but my life, it'll improve. You just don't know how it's going to improve.
That's right. And our job, I believe our job as sponsors is to make it clear to them that, you know, it's probably not going to be like you think it's going to be, but you're going to be able to learn how to deal with that.
Well, and you get to be open-minded and you get to realize that, you know, maybe you don't know, like the third step says, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't know I learned that a couple of times in sobriety, big time, is that mm-hmm. I don't know what's good for me.
Right.
A lot of times. The best scenario outcome that I can think of is far worse than what actually happened.
Right, right.
Right,
it's like we have a fellow who's fairly new into it, and his motto now is, if I think it's a good idea, it's probably not, and if I don't want to do it, I should probably do it. Speaking of doing it, we have done a whole show here, Kurt.
That's awesome.
And thank you so much for coming in and spending this time. Gotten to know a lot more about you now, and I will be sending you notes requesting money before I share it with anyone.
Yeah, exactly. Keep it to yourself.
Yeah. Mom, nobody will know. This is
you can send all the notes you want, and you know, you can't get blood out of a turnip.
That's right.
So,
so we'll wrap it up here, and I'll close it off with my usual. You know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol or other drugs or behavioral health issues, well... you do.